Hi, everyone. We have obviously a smaller group tonight because a lot of people are on vacation or away. It's December 30th, Hanukkah. People are at Hanukkah parties. The truth is, I wasn't sure whether I was going to be able to do the class because the whole day today I've been in bed. I've been sick. Now I'm starting to feel a little better. And I decided I'll give it a try. Hopefully, I can make it through and then go lay down again. But I do want to, maybe this will give me strength. So, thank you. We have a few more classes of Ram Oliver, and we're actually this will be the last one that we deal with. I think Eretz Yisrael, because there's more about him than that. But we still have things we need to do. First, let me pick up with last class. We saw that Ram Oliver suggested purchasing land or settling people Eiver HaYarden, and I said I don't know of any examples of settlements on the other side of the Jordan. Please tell me if there are. Well, thank you, Ben, who called my attention to the fact that, oops, hold on, that there was a settlement called Tel Or that existed from 1928 to 1948, when during the war, of course, it was people had to leave. So they did actually set up at least one settlement on the other side of the Jordan. He also called my attention to this. That lo and behold, the Jewish National Fund actually owns 53 square kilometers of land in Syria. They have the paperwork and everything. So I thought that's interesting. Finally, he tells me that we spoke about Rav Moliver and the idea, the issue of should non-religious Jews be told to come to live in Israel? And we went through the different C. Pesach Frank and others, and he says today it's the opposite. The former chief rabbi of Israel, Rav Yitzchak Yosef, told Haredim not to come to Israel unless they could live in a Haredi neighborhood. Actually, when he was in Jerba, he told the people, don't come to Israel unless you can live in Bnei Brak or a place like that. Now, if you know anything about the Jews in Jerba, they're not going to Bnei Brak. They're traditional Sephardic Jews. So you might say, well, isn't this in contradiction to the Rambam? The Rambam says that you should live in Eretz Yisrael, even in an area mostly, they're mostly idolaters, and live in a pious city in Chutz Haaretz. I don't think so, because remember, the standard view of this passage, the Gemara, the Rambam, is that you're going to remain religious. That is, you're going to move to Israel and you're going to live in a city full of idolaters, but you're going to remain religious. That there's no doubt about. In that case, you still should live with the idolaters. Rav Moliver's Chiddush was that even if there's a suffix, and even if in the end you become non-religious, obviously you can't go there and intend to be non-religious, but if in the end you become irreligious, it still is better that you're in Israel than having been in Chutz Haaretz. But that we said was a chiddush, something unique, I think, or it's based on hafla. One more thing about Eiver HaYarden, and Ibn Ezra, which we spoke about. If you look in where is it? In Re'eh, here it is, Parshas Re'eh. Moshe says, "Behold," or God says, "I set before Moshe a blessing and a curse." And then it says in Pasuk Chaf Tes, where is it? Hold on, let me look here. I thought it was here. Ah, yes, here in Pasuk 30. Moshe, they're on the other side of the Jordan, and Moshe says about the people on the other side of the Jordan, that is in Eretz Yisrael, Canaan, are they not beyond the Jordan? Halo heima be'Eiver HaYarden. So we see from this that the way it usually works is that whatever side of the Jordan you're on, you speak of the other side of the Jordan as the one you're not on. So here we see on the eastern side of the Jordan, speaking about Eiver HaYarden on the western side of the Jordan. If you're in living in Eretz Yisrael, you would speak about Eiver HaYarden as referring to the eastern side of the Jordan. So I showed you this passage in Devarim. It says, "Ela Devarim." These are the words which Moshe spoke to all of Israel, but Eiver HaYarden. So if that's the assumption that you speak about the other side of the Jordan always when you're on the opposite side. Then, and this is what Ibn Ezra's hint is, that this has to be from a post-Mosaic prophet because Moshe on the eastern side of the Jordan speak about himself as being Aver HaYarden. Aver HaYarden, if you're staying on the eastern side, is the land on the western side. So I want to thank, and by the way, if you look at Ibn Ezra, he gives four more examples of psukim that he believes are written by post-Mosaic prophets. I thank David, who called my attention to the fact that Shadal, Shmuel David Watzato, actually picks up on this point. And although he acknowledges that the other four examples that Ibn Ezra gives of secrets are his hints that these are post-Mosaic prophecies, he does not accept the point about Aver HaYarden. He quotes one of the commentaries of Ibn Ezra, who says this, and he says this is completely wrong. He says Spinoza also said this. He said that Aver HaYarden can be used referring to either side. And if I'm on the eastern side of the Jordan, like at the beginning of Devarim, I can refer to that as Aver HaYarden. It doesn't have to do with where you're standing at all. Now, my only question for Shadal is, then what's the point of this pasuk at the beginning of Devarim, saying if you understand the secret of the 12, you'll understand all these other verses? The whole point is he's putting it together with Aver HaYarden, at least so it seems. But Shadal thinks differently. So thank you very much, David, for pointing that out. Okay, everyone, let's pick up now. I think there's one major point I still want to talk about Eretz Yisrael. It's a very interesting one. In Rav Moliver's report, which we spoke about last class, why he went to Eretz Yisrael, he says as follows. He speaks about how we're going to settle the land. The Ramban calls it a mitzvah for all generations. He says it's obvious that we're not going to acquire the land al yedei milchama, through war. Because we have no ability, we're not permitted to battle today's day and age. As it explains, he says in Tractate Ketubot that God commanded the Jews not to rebel against the nations among who we live. So let me show you what he's referring to here. If you look in, Ketubot, chapter 111a, the Gemara, it's deriving from Shir HaShirim, and it says as follows. It says that there are three oaths. One is that the Jews should not ascend to Eretz Yisrael as a wall. And Rashi explains what this means as a wall, Yachad Biyad Chazaka, that is to go up, to conquer it. And the second is you should not rebel against the rule of the nations of the world. And the third is that the Holy One caused the nations to swear that they wouldn't subjugate the Jews excessively. Now, this text has had a long history, and this becomes the basis of the Satmar position. Now, in case you're wondering, what do you mean, rebel against the nations? Didn't the United Nations give the State of Israel? Wasn't the League of Nations put forth a mandate? We know that Rameir Simcha, the Or Sameach, after the San Remo conference, he says, we're not afraid anymore of the Shuot. Well, the Satmar Rebbe makes this a major point of his theology. He's not the first one. The Rashab, the Rebbe Rashab of Chabad, mentions it, as does the Munkacher of Chaim Moshe Shapiro. But for the Satmar Rebbe, it's a big deal. And he points out that the fact is that the UN has no right, to do this. If the Arabs are living there and the Arabs haven't given up their rights to the land, therefore, by the Jews coming in and taking it, that's rebelling. And I'm not going to go into his whole idea, and you see it in his book, Vayoa Moshe, because it pretty much has been unanimously rejected by everyone except for the followers of Satmar. I mean, the Litvisher Rabbanim, who were very opposed to Zionism, those that were very opposed, Chaim Soloveitchik and others, didn't speak of the three Shavuot for the simple reason that everything was being done. They were buying land, and it wasn't being done in opposition to anyone. They weren't going up to conquer the land. What these Lithuanian rabbis focused on was the fact that Zionism, in their eyes, was to create a new religion, not a Torah religion, but a secular type of Judaism. Okay, but Rav Moliver mentions the Gimel Shvuos, the three Shvuot. Now, in religious Zionism, anyone who studies this will know there's all sorts of explanations as to why the Gimel Shvuot don't apply. Well, first of all, it's not mentioned in the Shulchan Aruch, it's not mentioned in the Rambam, it's an agadic statement. in 1948 and before 1948, everything was done with the approval of the governments that controlled the land. And you go on and on with all the reasons why the Gimel Shvuos, the three Shvuos, don't apply. Some have said that they depend on each other. So clearly, after the Holocaust, you can't say that the non-Jews fulfilled their part of the bargain not to oppress the Jews too much. So that's. And if you had a religious Zionist education at a high level, you probably were taught that this position is nonsense. No one's ever held this. And yet the fact is it's not nonsense. There have been people, although it's not halacha. I mean, assuming it's not halacha, it's not in the Rambam, it's not in the Shulchan Aruch. Not everything that Jews do is halacha. There's a lot of values we have that are not legal, pure halacha. We have Masorah, we have all sorts of things. Hashkafic ideas that are not, I can't show you a place, an actual halacha, but they're very important. And I have to say this, but it's maybe some of the religious Zionists may be upset. But the truth is that this idea of not going up, the three oaths, was taken very seriously by many figures throughout Jewish history, that is, Rabbanim. And they saw it as something binding. Now, true, by the time you get to the 20th century, it's for almost all of them, it's no longer relevant because the governments have agreed, the Turkish and the British. However, the idea that this is just an ecstatic statement, you don't need to take it seriously, that is not historically true. Many people took it very seriously, the three oaths, and that's why Rav Molliver feels the need to stress that what we're doing is not in violation of the oaths. In fact, let me share with you something here from Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. If you look in his book Chorev, section what is this? Section 608, he speaks about the three oaths. He says that wherever we're living here, we have to work hard to be a productive citizen and support the lands we're living in. We wait the return to the land of Israel only when God brings us, but it's forbidden for us to gather the exiles or our connection to the land of Israel in any practical way. Why? Because of the three oaths. Now, I'm looking right here at a Hebrew translation of Chorev, and in the brackets, someone writes, after he says that we're forbidden to use any practical means to, bring bring the Jews in the diaspora back to the land of Israel, or to hold, to acquire territory there. In brackets, he says, "Beli reshut umot ha'olam," without the permission of the nations. But Hirsch doesn't say that, and we know that when Rav Seirsch Kalischer asked Hirsch to support settlements that are bought, purchased legally. He refused, and he says what Kalischer thinks is a big mitzvah, he thinks is not a small aveira. So Hirsch saw the idea of the three oaths as binding, and that was the reason I wouldn't say anti-Zionist, because Zionism didn't exist yet, but anti-Chibat Zion. And what about the fact that the nation? So it says we can't rebel against the nations of the world, and we can't go up with strength. So what does that mean? That's what Rashi says, go up with strength. How is buying territory going up with strength? Well, Hirsch never explains it, and it's hard to see how, unless you say that this was absentee landlords who were selling, and it wasn't really didn't reflect the people who lived there. I'm not sure. I find it problematic what Hirsch says. And what about the third point? That he says that the third oath, that the nations, he says that regarding the third oath, the nations have to judge themselves whether they treated us properly. And then he continues to say that we need to fulfill our obligations living here, be good citizens, dealing the machusa. And he says that this obligation for us to be a good citizen is absolute and has no connection to how the non-Jews treat us. Whether they treat us properly or not, and even if they remove from us zechuyot ha'adam, basic rights, and nevertheless, we have to remain a loyal citizen. This is a position I think that you'd be hard pressed to support. The idea that we look, it is true that Dina de Mahusa Dina, I mentioned it before, is not voided because the government is oppresses Jews, but there's a limit. There has to be a little oppression. It can't be a lot of oppression. He makes it seem that it doesn't matter how they treat us, even if they remove our rights, we still have to remain a good citizen. So if you want to call that a Goyist mentality, okay, it's interesting. Now, as for the Satmar Rebbe's point, and I guess it'll be Hirsch's point also, I found something interesting. If you look in Rav Herzog's Responsa, Volume 1, Or HaChaim, number 52, he says that the Arabs never had Zechut Malchut Baratzeinu. The Arabs never, yeah, they lived there, but they never had any Zechus. They never had any rights over the land. It was conquered by the Turks, and then it was conquered by the British. So the fact that the Arabs lived there, that doesn't give them any rights to it. Then he says that, in his opinion, he doesn't think that any nation really has the right to control Eretz Yisrael. He thinks that the whole idea of the oath not to rebel against the nations, this refers to Jews living in Chutz La'aretz, that they shouldn't like rebel as people did. They rebelled against the Roman Empire, things like that. But when it comes to Eretz Yisrael, the nations have no rights on Eretz Yisrael, and therefore the whole concept doesn't apply. So that's an interesting point there. Okay, let us pick up. In 1893, Rav Mollaver establishes something he calls Hamerkaz Haruchani, which was known as Mizrahi. This is not the same Mizrahi that exists to this day, that was founded by the religious Zionists or Rhinists. The Merkaz Ruchani of, although it has the same name, the Merkaz Ruchani founded by Rav Mollaver does not mention observance of the Torah in its statutes, and he founded it together with Moshe Leib Lilienblum, who was irreligious. The purpose was to take a more activist role in Chovei Tzion than was being done by the others, Zionists. And the idea was that when it comes to settling the land of Israel, we have to work with everyone, religious and non-religious. Now, at the beginning of this organization, there were many rabbis who supported it, but a number of them would later leave it. They saw that they can't stay together with the irreligious. It just doesn't work. I'm speaking of many names I mentioned already: Yonatan Eliasberg, Yoshua Yosef Prale. That's the brother. He died young. He's the brother of Rabbi Prale, the father-in-law of Rabbi Teitz. He was one of these up-and-coming stars, writers, responding to the Maskilim. And even Rabbi Rhinus would leave Rav Mollaver's organization. I can't remember if we mentioned this. Hold on a second. One of the things that were established was, hold on a second. Gan Shmuel. And we're going to come back to that later. It's a kibbutz in northern Israel, and it's named after, it began as an etrog orchard, and it's named after Rav Mollaver. I want to read you a few more things from, I have to tell you, I'm really sorry. I'm glad that we got to come here tonight and share, but it's coming over me again. And yes, thank you, Jacob, for pointing out Kisei Rachamim in B'nai Brak. I'm really starting to feel sick again, so I'm going to have to unfortunately end it. We're not going to meet next week. I won't be here, but I'll be back in 2 weeks and 3 weeks. A lot of interesting stuff still to do, including various halachic rulings of Rav Mollaver and differences between him and Herzl. But unfortunately, I have to end tonight. I'm really feeling sick now. But thank you for coming out, and hopefully, I'll have a refuah shleimah. Thank you. Okay, those who are with me 2 weeks ago know that I couldn't get through. I was sick, but we're gonna post the 2 week 20 minutes of 2 weeks ago. They'll be combined with this class. So let us pick up. I just want to, we've gone through basically his views on Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. So today, just a few more things about Yishuv Eretz Yisrael and then other aspects. He wasn't encompassed only by living by issues of the land of Israel. But if in the book, Brit Ahava Shalom, pages 324 to 325, he has a letter here, which he sent to a Rabbi Shlomo Yitzhak Sheinfeld, who it says here was the at this time was the rabbi of Louisville, Kentucky, but later he was the rabbi in Milwaukee. He is interesting for another reason. He's a Musmach Eretz Ochanan, but he publishes an article at the early part of the 20th century saying that we have to have a different conception of prayer. All that we're never going to have sacrifices again. That's not what God wants from us. And Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg actually responds to this article of his and. You might think they would have thrown him out of the rabbinate, but no, he remained the rabbi of Milwaukee with this view. And my book, by the way, on it was published officially on Friday on Rav Kook. And let me just show you here. Here you can. You can order. For some reason, Amazon is not taking orders anymore, pre-orders. I guess they got so many that they didn't want to take anymore till they have stock. But it's really the same price if you order it here on Liverpool University Press. I'll even put the link in there, but you just Google it. And in there, I discuss Rav Kook's view of sacrifices as well, that he also says that there will come a time in the future era when we won't have sacrifices. And he explains, doesn't this go against the Rambam Zikar of that the Torah law will never change, and he explains why it doesn't go against it. It's quite fascinating. Okay, so he writes this letter to Rabbi Sheinfeld, and he speaks about the importance, of course, of Eretz Yisrael, and then he says he wants to make clear, he says, that it really, at the end of the day, people have different reasons to why they value Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. He says some see it as equal to all the other mitzvahs, like the Gemara say. Others see it as the beginning of redemption. Others just believe in setting up a place where Jews can work the land, and others look at the land of our fathers, which we're now Tchiyas HaMeisim, reviving it. So I think that's interesting. He acknowledges that there's different reasons why people will be attracted to Eretz Yisrael, and that's fine. Now, for this all the success that Reb Oliver has. And the early Chovei Tzion, they did establish certain settlements. They weren't completely successful. So, for instance, Rav Moliver, he went to Paris and he had discussions with, hold on, where is he? This individual, actually Germany, I should say, Baron Hirsch, and he wanted Baron Hirsch, who was a big community philanthropist to fund the settlements. But as it says already in the first paragraph here, Baron Hirsch was founder of the Jewish Colonization Association, which sponsored large-scale Jewish immigration to Argentina. And he thought it was a pipe dream, Baron Hirsch. And he gave a lot of money, and Jews, he helped establish settlements in Argentina. In fact, if you go to Argentina, my daughter just got back a couple of days ago. She was in Chile and Argentina last week and the week before. And I told her she should go to Moiseville or Kiryat Moshe in Hebrew. There's a whole settlement that was set up by Baron Hirsch, which you can still go there. There aren't really Jews living there anymore, except for some old timers. But you have the shul, there's a museum, there was an agricultural settlement. Promise is too far from Buenos Aires, but he was responsible, Baron Hirsch. He thought that that's where Jews should go. So he wasn't successful in that respect. By the way, another interesting thing to point out is, well, even before I get to that, Salmon mentions that what the non-religious were becoming more and more involved. And Rav Moliver says something interesting, which I think remained the approach of Mizrahi really until today. First of all, he stresses anti-Semitism, that that's the reason why we need the land. He doesn't speak about messianic things like Rav Kook and, Rav Kook's whole idea that God is returning us to history. We were living this half existence in the Gaulis for 1900 years, 1850, 1850 years. Now God has signaled to us it's time to return to the land of Israel, and this is going to be the beginning of redemption. For Amolivar, it's much more practical, and he mentions anti-Semitism, but what about the non-religious? He says as follows, because we already saw this was an issue. He says that the land as a whole, in a communal sense, has to be run al pi halacha, in accordance with the Jewish law. And this is really, as Salmon points out, his formulation here is really where you get the notion of religious Zionism. Eretz Yisrael, Am Yisrael, al pi Torah Yisrael. That is the land of Israel for the people of Israel in accordance with the Torah of Israel. And Rav Molivar, although he doesn't use that slogan, he expresses the exact same idea that you need all three of these. However, Amolivar also says, and this I think is quite important, he says we are not interested in enforcing anashim pratim yechidim hanagatam. That is, we're not interested in private citizens. We want Eretz Yisrael in a communal sense to be run al pi halacha. Let's say the settlements should be run al pi halacha. If an individual privately in his home is not observant, that's not our concern. And here I think you see a distinction between the Haredi approach and what became the religious Zionist approach. The Mizrahi from the beginning always said that in the land, in the state of Israel, and before that, in pre-state times, in a communal sense, we want marriage and divorce to be run prop by halacha. We want public transportation, these sort of things to be run halacha. But if someone privately takes his car and drives to the beach, we're not interested in going into people's private lives. And you could say, well, this is just abandoning halacha, but that was never the approach of Mizrahi. And Rav Molivar already at the beginning sets this out. There is an article by a man named Erkin or Arkin, and he calls attention to interesting differences between Molivar and Herzl. I'll just mention a few of them. So one of the things he mentions is that one of the early figures in Tzion comes to Molivar and he asks him, what's the difference between you and Herzl? And he points out that, I don't know if you know this, one of the points of Herzl's argumentation was that the non-Jews should support Zionism because they don't like Jews. And there's the anti-Semite should support Zionism. I was looking for some things online, and I found something, a very detailed Wikipedia article here, Herzl's Meishel and Zionist Anti-Semitism. And it talks about, it's a very long Wikipedia. I don't know who put this together. The idea that the non-Jews don't like Jews. And but there's two types of anti-Semites. There's dignified anti-Semites, and that there's really evil anti-Semites. Herzl's whole approach was we can work with the dignified anti-Semites, the ones who don't want Jews around, but they're not bloodthirsty kind of anti-Semites. So you go to them and you explain to them, that we know that Jews create problems for you. They're very successful, and it creates all this tension. So how about you support us taking all these Jews out of your land? We'll be happy because now we'll have them all in the land of Israel, and you'll be happy because you won't have any Jews anymore. Herzl actually believed this, and I guess it makes a sort of sense in a sort of crazy way. And he says that Herzl explains that the Jews, there's revolutionary things among the young Jews, and it creates all sorts of problems, and therefore you should help us establish our nation, country. And Rabbi Molivar's perspective is different. He says he thought this was very dangerous to try to tell people, to try to raise the issue that Jews could be problems for your country and help us. So Rabbi Molivar, Histayego Chalutin, was completely opposed and removed himself entirely from Miderach HaTamua shel Herzl, that from this propaganda approach of Herzl. And what did he do? He Molivar thought the approach is that we should just speak in terms of we'll purchase land, and that the kings and the princes of the world should look kindly upon the Jews, that sort of thing. Not the anti-Semitic approach. Let's put it this way. Erkin gives other examples of differences between Romoliver and Herzl, although Romoliver admired Herzl and vice versa. But Herzl thought, and he writes, that the new homeland is going to be like Switzerland. Everyone would speak their own language. You'd have different cantons. Herzl couldn't imagine a situation where everyone's going to speak one new language, Hebrew, which wasn't even a spoken language. He thought that people would come from all over, and like in Switzerland, you have different languages. People would settle in different areas. And Romoliver thought that Hebrew, he believed in a revival of spoken Hebrew. Of course, it's just a dream, but everything's a dream. Settling the land, bringing Jews from all over the world's a dream. Of course, when Romoliver speaks about things about Hebrew, he's speaking Ashkenazic Hebrew, speaking that way. And I mean, you can speak Hebrew Ashkenazic. I don't know if Eliezer ben Yehuda, I can't recall now if he ever spoke Ashkenazic. I think early on he spoke Sephardic because he thought that that would work best. But we know that people spoke Ashkenazic Hebrew when they taught Hebrew in the Tarbut schools, let's say in Vilna before the war. They taught them Ashkenazic. They didn't teach them Sephardic. I just was reading something about Ramosha. Who was it? So with regard to the Langer dispute, so I'm reading up on it now, and there's a visit where Shazar comes to Ramosha Feinstein to try to make some sort of peace. And the Ramosha speaks, and he can understand and speak in Ashkenazic Hebrew. So they spoke a little Ashkenazic Hebrew before they moved into Yiddish. But Ramoliver was involved with the new school in Yafo that had Hebrew as its language of instruction. And I'm certain that at the end of the 19th century, this would have been Ashkenazic Hebrew. Look, Bialik's Hebrew is Ashkenazic Hebrew. His poetry is Ashkenazic. You can see from where the stresses are. So there's no reason to think in the late 19th century that it wouldn't be Ashkenazic. Why not? But it's, as we know, it became mostly Sephardic. Not entirely Sephardic, because there's a few things in the language that so for instance well we know even in pronunciation kamatz and patach, but there's a couple things where they adopted Ashkenazic, even segel by the way, and seyre they also adopted the Sephardic. It escapes me now, but there's a few things that in the pronunciation that they adopted the Ashkenazic. And as you know, in the we've spoken about this before, in Hatikvah, it's not Hatikvah, it's Hatikvah. That's actually Ashkenazic as well, the pronunciation. Herzl wanted complete separation of synagogue and state. He said that the place of the rabbis is the synagogue, just like the place of the army is in the barracks. And we don't bring the army out into the street, they remain in the barracks because we don't have, it's not a military dictatorship. So too, the place of the rabbis is in the synagogue, and they shouldn't be involved in public life. Rav Moliver believed that the Torah, of course, needs to be the basis of communal life and law. And you can't just put the Torah in the synagogues. No, the Torah has to be has to influence the nation as a whole. And finally, Erkin points to the fact that Herzl was willing to establish the Jewish state anywhere in the world. The preference was the land of Israel, but if you couldn't get that, somewhere else. And Rav Moliver only focused on Eretz Yisrael, and anything else was unimaginable to him. But really, the issue wasn't really raised before that other places in a realistic sense. I mean, unless you think Argentina as an example, but no, I'm thinking Uganda, which really happens after Rav Moliver, but Rav Moliver's stress was only on Eretz Yisrael. Rav Moliver, the last thing he does with regard to Eretz Yisrael, and Salmon in his book Im Ta'iru Im Ta'oru on page 162 mentions it. This was in 1898, 2 days before his death, that he publishes a document regarding the colonial bank they were going to establish. It's like he calls it like an Anunnaki, and in this, he puts forth some major ideas that he's said a number of times, but that the Yishuv in Eretz Yisrael has to be with the permission of the Turkish government, and that's where we need to work. Number one, and everything needs to be in accord with halacha. Okay, obviously this is something shouldn't surprise us. He's been saying this for years, and then he passes away 2 days later. Yud Tet Sivan, I guess that's May or maybe early June of 1898. Salmon says it's doubtful if there was another rabbi in his day who created such feeling, such excitement in the Jewish people. That is because this idea of returning to the land, especially in the Russian Empire, and he became, as Salmon says, a symbol. You know, I think of him with the long beard, the pious rabbi. He became the symbol of those who thought that, yes, we could have a synthesis, a joining of traditional Judaism and religious Zionism, for even though the term Zionism really doesn't it what Chavetz, I should say. He was also, as Salmon says, a symbol for traditional Judaism at the end of the 19th century. Not because of the Sfarim he wrote. He really didn't write Sfarim. We're going to see after his death, they published a volume of Responsa, but his writings, there was a pogrom in Bialystok after his death, and his writings were all lost, almost all his writings. This is in 1906. But in his lifetime, he was too busy with the other things. He didn't really publish much. So it was his public appearance that made him such an important rabbi. Now, Moliver, I mean, Professor Salmon calls attention, just to give you an example of how significant he was in the public imagination. Salmon calls attention to this book. There's a book, it's called Hespeidmar, a bitter Hespeid. Not that Hespeid's bitter, but a feeling of bitterness. And it's, as you see, Al Rav Agon Amiti, at Tzadik Tamim, Rav Shmuel Moliver. And this was shortly after he died in 1898. It's written by a rabbi, Mordechai Schatz, a rabbi in Lita. He actually is the son of this rabbi. Meir Yona Bronsky, also known as Meir Yona Schatz. I don't know why he had both names. If you read the literature, in his time, this Meir Yona Bronsky was considered one of the Gedolei Yisrael. In fact, he was Av Beis Din for a short time in Brisk. And then he moved on and to Svislovt, so I don't know how you pronounce it even. And his successor was the Beis HaLevi in Brisk. You could see he wrote a number of books here at the bottom. But today he's completely unknown, of course. In this book, this Hespeidmar, Rabbi Mordechai Schatz mentions that in the space he goes through like 7 years, seven Gedolei Yisrael died. And this to show you how important Rav Moliver was in the imagination. Look at who the seven he considers to be the greatest Gedolim who died during that period. Well, first of all, he mentions his father, which is to be expected. And then he goes on, Tzvi Aryeh Leib, Reish Masechta Devoshin. He calls Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. As he passed away, but Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, Naftali Tzvi's name was never Aryeh Leib. I don't know why he doesn't call him Natsali Tzvi. He calls him, he was called Leib, Naftali Tzvi Leib, but never Aryeh, as far as I know, although that would be the Hebrew. So that's the first one. Who's the second one? Yosef Dov Ber Av Beis Din of Brisk, the Beis HaLevi, the successor of his father. Then Yerucham Aryeh Leib, the Gadol of Minsk, Yerucham Perlman. These are obviously Gedolei. These are like Gedolei of the top level. And the 19th century in Lithuania was full of Gedolei. But these were the ones who stood above. Then who else? Yitzchak Chanan Spector. Then Yeshua Aryeh Leib of Brisk, who then goes to Eretz Yisrael. That's Yeshua Aryeh Leib Diskin. And finally, Rav Moliver. So look who Rav Moliver is put in together with among the Gedolei Yisrael there. You see where he's at. Now we have the record of the funeral of Rav Molavar. I found it on, I mean, I pulled it up online here. This is from Hamelitz. As you can see it here, Chav Zayin Sivan. So here you have a letter, the first page, letters from Bialystok, and it's about the Avel Kaved. I don't know if it's Avel or Avel. The truth of the matter is, it's like in the Mishnah Torah, the second to the last book of the Mishnah Torah. The second to last section, right before, if I'm right before Hilchos Malachim, I believe, right? Is it Hilchos Avel or Hilchos Avel? I forget now. Hold on a second. I can pull it up right now. We can see. So here they have it in the Chabad one. They translate it as Avel. Others translate it as Avel. Avel as in like mourning versus Avel as mourner. I'm not sure if anyone knows how it should be translated. By the way, this shows. That's interesting. Chaim Soloveitchik once spoke about this, about the Mishnah Torah, that it's not always clear. It seems like the Rambam wasn't didn't always know where to put things, and we know that there's been more than one edition he had or working on the Mishnah Torah where to put things. So book 11, well, let's just say here, like, why would you put Hilchos Avel in Sefer Shoftim? It should maybe be in Sefer Tara or in maybe Sefer Zmanim or Sefer Ava. It's a strange place to put it. And but you see this in the Shulchan Aruch also, right? The Shulchan Aruch, where does Hilchos Tzedakah go in? It should be in Or HaChaim, but or Hilchos Tefillin. Hilchos Tefillin should be in Or HaChaim. What is it in Mezuzah? What are they doing in sorry, Hilchos Mezuzah. Hilchos Tefillin is in Or HaChaim, right? But Hilchos Mezuzah is in Yoredeiah. And also the mourning, the laws of Avelos is in Yoredeiah. It's a little strange. But here you have the letters from Bialystok. So it begins, how it was a terrible day. You know, Rav Molavar died, they call him Rabbeinu. But look what it says, the first two lines. It says that the masses were coming, Habit al gufo hatahor b'pam achrona. You know, Rav Molavar passes away, and before they bury him, you know, we don't have open caskets. We're not like the Catholics at a wake, but you can see online sometimes when the great Rosh Yeshiva dies. You could go online, you could see it. Like I remember when Rav Shmuel Auerbach died, they left his body on the ground, and people came to observe it. Now you can't see it; it's covered in the talus. But I saw the pictures on the Kikar Shabbat. That's the Haredi website. So I don't know how, I guess you leave it there until the funeral. The funeral's in the afternoon, so you leave it there all morning. So here we see that people would come to see Rav Molavar. He'd be laying on the ground of his house. I don't know if we, I mentioned that I saw them doing this in Israel with Rav Shmuel Auerbach. I don't know if this is a common thing. You can tell me, because it's really not a tourist attraction to come see, but that we see that's what they're doing. And then on the next page, it says, and this is really interesting, I think, it mentions who came to the funeral. Of course, it says the great rabbis who came. Who's the first one? Rav Chaim Soloveitchik of Brisk. And then it gives some other names that are not so well known today, but were great rabbis in their day. This one is interesting to me, Rav Eliyahu Baruch Mechechanovitza. That we call or Chechanovitz. That is Eliyahu Baruch Kamai. He was the Rav of Chechanovitz, and then he becomes the Rav of in the city of Mir and the Rosh Yeshiva of Mir. His son is Rav Avram Svirosh Kamai, who does not leave Mir when the yeshiva leaves, even though he's one of the Rosh Yeshiva there, because he's also the Rav of the city, and he's martyred. So why is this so significant for me, Eliyahu Baruch Kamai of Chechanovitz? Because Eliyahu Baruch, because Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg is born in Chechanovitz, and that's the city. And those who went to the seminary might know the name Shraga Abramson. Shraga Abramson is also from Chechanovitz, but Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg was born there when Eliyahu Baruch was the Rav. And I give some other names, Shmuel Yaakov Rabinovitz. He later becomes a Rav in Liverpool, England, the Lady Mizrahi rabbi. But so we see the Reb Chaim Brisker came to the funeral. Now, if there's a book called Uvdos Van Hagos Mibeis Brisk, which are all these stories from the Brisker dynasties. And it's fascinating how they get this wrong. Their heart's in the right place, and I give them a lot of credits, but they get the facts wrong. If you look on page volume two, page 208, I'm just going to summarize you what the story is here. They tell it says one time the Beis HaLevi said to Reb Shmuel Molliver that we are both elderly, and in a short time we're going to be in the next world, and then you will see what a mistake you made. Chovei Tzion. Because in this world you can't see the mistake, but in the next world it'll be clear. And then he says that. Then he goes on and says, when Reb Molliver died, Maran Hagon Reb Chaim wanted to go to the funeral, but the people in his house around him, they not his family. It means the people who would hang out in his house. I think this means they wondered about this. They said, your entire life, you fought against Zionism. I don't know why they say Zionism. This is Chovei Tzion. It's not really Zionism, but whatever. He said, you fought against Zionism. I don't have any evidence. I don't know, really, other than this report, that Reb Chaim was against Chovei Tzion. The Netziv wasn't against it. Rabbi Tzalkanan wasn't against it. I mean, yes, Shamshon Raphael Hirsch is against it, but which Lithuanian rabbis were against it? Yes, towards the end, when it looks like the irreligious are taking more control, people back away from it. But I don't know of any real public opponents of it, like you'll find later when it becomes a real political movement. Okay, but they say that the Reb Chaim was so against Zionism. If you go to the funeral, you're going to give strength to the Zionists. But it says Reb Chaim didn't care what they said, and he said one thing has nothing to do with the other. He says, yes, I fight against Zionism with all my strength, but I still have to go to the funeral of a rabbi, and this is a great rabbi who passed away. And I was Reb Chaim saying, one thing has nothing to do with the other. Reb Molliver was a Gadol b'Yisrael. I disagree with his approach, but still I have to go to the funeral. And it says they sent one of the big balabatim that Reb Chaim would consult with to speak to Reb Chaim. And he also said that it's usur for Reb Chaim to go to the funeral because he'll strengthen Zionists. And it says here, Kas ma'od, Maran Hagaon Reb Chaim Zatzal, that Reb Chaim was very angry. And he says, She'eno mevin ezo shaychus yesh lazeh im nesios ol halavaya. He says he doesn't understand what does going to the funeral of a great rabbi who we disagreed on this matter of Zionism have to do with strengthening Zionism. And he says, and this is what it ends here. Reb Chaim said, since nevertheless, since the world of the people are stupid, and they will make a mistake, they will think because I went to the funeral, that means I support Zionism. Lo yisa. So, since the world is stupid and they're making a mistake, he will not go. He didn't, but that's not true. I totally believe the discussions here, where the people tried to convince Reb Chaim not to go, and he said that I don't accept it. I'm going to go because one thing's not the other. The only difference is that it's wrong here to say what they say, that in the end, Reb Chaim decided to listen to the stupid people because he was worried that in the end, they're so stupid they're going to make the wrong conclusion that he didn't go. He did go to the funeral. Not only did he go to the funeral, Reb Ochanan Wasserman went to the funeral with him as well. Now, that's not reported in the Hametz article because in those days, Reb Ochanan Wasserman wasn't a significant person. He was a young man, fairly young man. So they don't report that. But Reb Chaim went with Reb Ochanan Wasserman, and the Chazon Ish explained that they went to show that the dispute with Reb Molliver was about a shita, was about a position. when the irreligious were involved. It wasn't personal when they had great respect for Rav Molavar as a personality. This reminds me, by the way, this idea that the stupid people will misconstrue it. In my book, Changing the Immutable, I have a picture here from this biography that came out on Rav Aaron Cutler. And they have the picture there, the famous picture of Rav Aaron Cutler and Irving Bunim. But they don't have the person who's on the side of Irving Bunim, namely of Soloveitchik. He cuts it out. And when the book appeared, maybe it was 2013, I think, the author has since passed away. I heard that he was confronted by this, and his reply was, yes, he cut it out because he didn't want people to get the wrong impression. Now, what's the wrong impression? That you can go to YU, I guess, because Rav Aaron Cutler could have a friendly relationship with the Rav. That means YU is kosher. I mean, I don't know. He obviously thinks his people are so unsophisticated that they can't appreciate the Rav Aaron Cutler of Soloveitchik can come together for a good cause, namely Torah Musoro. That doesn't mean Rav Aaron Cutler agrees with religious Zionism or Yeshiva University. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this guy is right, and the people that he's writing for really are that stupid. But I it's sort of the same thing. But we see that it's a nice story, but it's wrong. Reb Chaim went there to the funeral. In fact, in Uvdos VaHagos, Beis Brisk, Volume 4, page 149 has a different story. It has, even though Revelvel, Reb Chaim's son, was a big kanai, and yes, he was a big kanai, perhaps even a bigger kanai than his father. Nevertheless, he respected Torah scholars who had a different approach, even when he thought they disagreed. And then it says, when the Satmar Rebbe visited the land of Israel, he refused to fly El Al when he came. He went to see the Brisker Rav. And they were speaking about how bad the situation is, and they began to speak about Zionism, not surprisingly, and the rabbis of Chibat Zion, and the Satmar Rebbe, who was a Kanai ben Kanai, it says here. It says that when he mentioned Rabbi Molavar, he called him Shmuel Molavar. Maran Hagriz Shama Vatikim ben Yehusa, when the Brisker Rav heard him say Shmuel Molavar, he corrected him. Rav Shmuel, Rav Shmuel. So look, at the end of the day, I think that's the most we can hope for. And I think we could declare it a Yom HaTavah LeRabbanan, a great feast for the rabbis. If you could actually disagree philosophically, but still refer to them respectfully. That is, it would be great if, let's say, in the 60s, in the right-wing world, they could disagree with Rav Soloveitchik all they want, and there is what to disagree with about Mizrahi, about secular university, all that. But don't call him JB. I mean, refer to him with respect, and that's a problem, unfortunately. But you see that the Brisker Rav, he was careful to show respect. Now, this respect for Rav Molavar, however, was not universal. So, for instance, Ben Zion Dinur, old yeshiva bacher, who then becomes a Jewish historian, irreligious, a Zionist, one of those many who went to yeshiva, a big Talmud Chacham, but then went to the other side, the Zionist side, not the religious Zionist side. He was learning in Tells at that time, and he reports that Rav Eliezer Gordon, Rosh Yeshiva of Tells, would not give a hesped for a Molavar. He only added a few words. He was being maspid, giving a hesped for another rabbi, and he added a few words in about Rav Molavar, but he wouldn't do a complete hesped. And look, some rabbis, they have a problem. They have a difficulty. If they feel that if they're going to give a hesped, they have to agree on everything, and otherwise it becomes problematic. That was the issue with the Jewish Observer. They felt like they had to say something when Rav Soloveitchik passed away, but they couldn't give like a regular hesped, because then I guess people would get the wrong impression. That, which again, I'm not sure what the wrong impression should be. You can give a hesped for the Lubavitcher Rebbe. You can give a, they gave a plenty of their hesped for the Satmar Rebbe. Everyone knows they don't agree with the Satmar approach, but you can give a hesped and also say we didn't agree with this. But nevertheless, couple of the things I want to point out. Okay, so this is Ramon Oliver. We've covered his life. Really, what made him who he was Chofetz Zion. Had it not been for Chofetz Zion, he would have been like a lot of other Rabbanim, Talmidei Chachamim, but he wouldn't have been an international figure. He wouldn't have been someone that today we still remember him. And you'll see at the end, I'll mention in particular how we remember him. There's other things I want to talk about now. He was a posek, and unfortunately, not much survived, but we do have a volume of Shelos and Tshuvos. I'll show you some interesting ones and some other things as well. So, this thing, which I don't know if before October 7th, if I would have paid attention to this, but now I do pay attention to it, and I'm going to share with you what I found in the book here. And it's actually, it was the subject, what I'm going to talk about now. How we're supposed to enjoy, relax, all these things, you know, with a war going on. A few Shabbos ago, I was at my parents in Boca Grove, and Rabbi J.J. Schachter was there, and he gave a shiur on this very theme Saturday night. It's in the book, Brit Ahavah Shalom, on page 196 to, sorry, 197 to 198. We have a letter here. This is from 1894, and there's bad things that have been going on. You have pogroms and difficult times. In fact, he says that he talks about the difficult times. He doesn't mention Russia, maybe because of the censorship, but we know difficult times are going to Russia. And then he says in Romania and Morocco, where there was problems for Jews there that were reported. You had difficulties in Morocco as well. It's funny that the editor of this doesn't know what Morocco is. He says it's Mem Aleph Resh Aleph Kuf Aleph, and he says that he thinks this is referring to Marco, which is a place in Italy. I don't know why he doesn't understand. It's Morocco. There's no, just because he didn't spell it Mem Resh Vav Kuf Vav, that's how modern Israelis spell it. But this is Morocco. He says, he writes to this group, the head of B'nai Moshe, which is part of the Chofetz Zion. He says that I saw in one of the newsletters that you have a th you're putting on in Yafo in Chol Hamoed Pesach a theatrical production. And he says, how can you put a theatrical production on? Es Sarah Hil Yaakov, B'chol Mokomos. And then he goes on that. And especially even in Israel, you need the support of Jews in the diaspora, and Jews in the diaspora are suffering under pogroms and difficulty, and you're going to have a theater, a play, and rikud and dancing, and he's saying you can't do that. And you know, it reminds me because I mean, what are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to stop enjoying? Are we supposed to stop having fun? Are we supposed to give another victory to Hamas? That on the other hand, you know, there's a war and people are being killed. And so where to, how to draw the line? It's, I think, look, I think we've assumed after the first couple of weeks, life has to go on. And that there's a show, by the way, that I was booked. And I'm not going to mention the name, but I hope they're listening to this now. They booked me to go speak there. And this is 2 months after October 7th. And then they call me like a week before. Everything's booked. The flight, the people are not up to it. It's too difficult with the situation in Israel. And I'm like, I'm coming to teach Torah and things like that. That's not a reason. I mean, it's you don't cancel something for that. But I understand the first couple of weeks, people would cancel events. You know, you're not going to have like you wouldn't have a play. You know, with a lot of singing and dancing, and you know, the week after October 7th. But eventually, things have to go back to normal. We can't say Avinu Malkeinu every day. Yeah, it loses its meaning. So, and by the way, is my I was in Israel not long after, and in Israel they came back. It's amazing. Israel, that's fighting and dying, they came back to normal much quicker than in America and Canada. Maybe because they feel that, you know, they've lost so much, they're not gonna give up for more. And I mean, there were people saying we shouldn't go on trips. If you go, you should only go to Israel. You go all over the world. Israelis were going all over the world. And I think maybe there was a guilt for people in America. They felt that it more pious than the Pope. They were doing things that in Israel itself they weren't doing. So it's interesting to where to find the middle ground. And Ramo Oliver is saying, we shouldn't be doing this because of the tsarist, but at the end of the day, Jews are always having tsarists. So I don't know how long and how long you're supposed to do that, and I'll leave it for the rabbis and others to deal with it. But it caught my eye when I was reviewing this a few weeks ago, that this is the same issue that we were dealing with in the weeks after October 7th. Okay, I want to go through the time we have left today, and then I'll continue next class. Some interesting responsa, at least I found it interesting, of Rav Moliver. Probably one of them deals, Rav Moliver is like the first one or one of the first ones to deal with the dateline. I'll get to that next class. But just some interesting tshuvot and halachic issues that he deals with, and then some other matters, and then we'll bring it to a close next week. I have things I want to share with you, including something about the Pioneer Hotel. I have an audio. Well, wait, but this is interesting stuff. But I'll wait till we start the next class, as well as something from our friend Rabbi Tzvi Reisman, another interesting halachic thing he mentions that in terms of forum shopping about Pesach. So, but we'll get to that once we start the new session. But let me call your attention to a few things that I found interesting. There's a halacha. Well, let me show you here in the Shulchan Aruch. We all know what a Beis Din is, and you go to a Beis Din, and the Beis Din rules. Hold on a second. So here's a Shulchan Aruch, Choshen Mishpat, Siman Yud Beis. So it says in Halacha Beis, in Choshen Mishpat, it's a mitzvah. You tell when they come to you, that is people having a dispute, at the beginning of the dispute, you say, do you want Din? Or do you want pshara? That is, do you want the actual law to be decided, or do you want to compromise? And really, if you're sure you're going to win, you're probably going to want the din. But if you're not sure and you want pshara, and pshara is always good, batei din always want make some sort of compromise. I heard a shiur from Rabbi Yonah Reis. On the he's one of the Dayanim from now he's in Chicago, he's on the RCA Beis Din, but he spoke about cases he's involved with. I think he's still involved with the RCA Beis Din about Pesharo. Okay, so they talk about, so they give him the option. And then it says, and it talks about the Shulchan Aruch says that after they any Beis Din that does Pesharo, that's a very good thing, it's Meshubach. And then it says, when should we do this? Before you finish the din. But after you finish the din, then you're not allowed to do pshara. That is, the din's been there, then once the dayanim rule on it, then you can't come up and say, well, the dayan can't then come and say, well, you know, the law's decided, let's now do pshara. Another person who's not a dayan, he can come to them and say it's due pshara. But the dayan, once they've given the ruling, that's it. They can't then try to say, "Well, yes, we gave the law, and Reuven won over Shimon." But still, how about we do some pshara here? No, that you were supposed to do that beforehand, not afterwards. So that's the halacha. But Rav Moliver, but not everyone agrees with this, and. It's some say that even after the Gemara din, after the din, you can still you look in the Shach on the spot there that cites the Riyaz, that you can still try to come to a Pshar. Okay, so you have a dispute, the Shulchan Aruch and the others. Can you do a Pshara compromise afterwards? What Rav Moliver says, and I think this is interesting because he tells us the practice of Batei Din in Lithuania was, he says, "Bevadai mitzvah gedola hi imro hadayin shas shalom ayadeze." Rav Moliver says he sides with the view in opposition to Shulchan Aruch that it's a mitzvah even after the ruling has been given. If a dayan can still make pshara, it's a mitzvah. V'chein ha'minag pashut b'chol batei din shebi Yisrael. Rav Moliver tells us that this is the practice of all the batei din. He's speaking about in the area he knows in Lithuania. I'd be curious to know today what the RCA and other batei din. But he says that this is the practice in all the batei din, that if after the psak they see that it can come to katata umariva, that it can come to disputes, We know that not everyone is agrees, even though they lose, not everyone accepts the judgment. Incidentally, there's a great vort on this by Rav Shmelk of Nicholsburg, as I recall. Oh, no, Mordechai Bennett, sorry. He was also Rav in Nicholsburg. You go to the Rav and you have a shiloh, a kashrus shiloh, even it can cost you thousands of dollars. You bring your animals, your chicken, whatever it is, a chametz, some pates, whatever it is. The Rav rule says, no, you have to throw it out. It's no good. Even if you're going to lose thousands of dollars, you accept it. You might be upset, but you're not angry at the Rav because what? The Rav is deciding halacha. You might be angry at the halacha. You're not angry at the Rav. However, you're in a case, a based in, or you go to the Rav to decide a case between you and someone else, and the Rav rules against you. Now you don't accept it. You hate the Rav. I think you're angry at the Rav. What's the difference? You lost the $2,000 before on the Kashrus case because the Rav said he can't find a heter. If the Tarfos fell into it, you accepted it. But in this case, you lost $2,000 and you're angry at the Rav because what you're really angry about is that the other person got the money. That's the anger. So, we know that after just because based in rules, it can lead to terrible disputes. So he says, Reb Oliver says, if you see that's going to happen, still try to do pshara even after the fact. That is, you can go to the person who won the judgment, and you can say to him, yes, by all rights, you can take all this money, but it'll be good for the community. It'll be good for you. It'll be good for everyone. It'll be good for your children. Whatever you want to say, you can try to make the man come to a compromise. And Ramover says that's fine, and that's a good thing to do. And he says, even especially, he says that today, he says we can't enforce rules like we like to, and therefore, in order to prevent controversy in the community, we're going to go in like the view not according to the Shulchan Aruch and try to make Peshara after the fact. I went through the tshuvos here, and I just found some interesting things. I think you'll find interesting also. Okay, we're in the season now of the same Tal Mutar, Livracha. We say we're asking for a rain. Okay, do we need rain? The whole issue: are we doing it for Bavo or Eretz Yisrael? Are we doing it for us? This became a big issue in the Southern Hemisphere. In Argentina, I think the psak today is that they switch it. They do it in different seasons. But that was a big machlokes. Also Australia as well. So you had some people who say you should switch it, or Ravadia said you should switch it, and others say no, that we really focused on Bavel and Eretz Yisrael because originally it was established in Bavel. So in the Middle East, okay. So let's say, what about us? So we say the same Talmud Torah. Do we really need it? Doesn't really matter, Eretz Yisrael. But here's the question. Let's say you forget the same Talmud Torah Livracha. And let's say we don't need it. It's one thing if you forget it and you need it. But let's say, look, we might need it, maybe for the reservoirs. I don't know. But let's on the assumption that we don't need rain and we forget it. Well, if I open up my Archul Siddur here, and it says as follows in the back, the laws. And some of these laws are impossible to do. It's like if you forget it, if you forget this, but you remember by this time in Shemoneh Esrei, if you remember by that time, what are you supposed to do? You forget, you're supposed to open up and look in the back and figure it out in the middle of Shemoneh Esrei. I'm not sure exactly how that's supposed to work. But if you forget it and you finish the entire Shemoneh Esrei, if you've already done Shemoneh Esrei, you didn't say the same Talmud Mutar, you must start again from the beginning. Okay. That's what it says. And that's what everyone's taught. However, if you open up the Aruch HaShulchan and take a look in Siman Kuf Yud Zayin, Halacha Zayin, he's not so clear on it. He says, he begins by saying that, if individuals need rain during the summer months, you can ask for it. You can always ask for it in Shema Kolenu. But then it says, if the Beis Yosef says that if an individual asked for rain, actually, I don't need to go into that, but he continues and says that in our countries, that is Russia, in the winter, where we don't need rain, if you didn't mention Tein Tal Matar, ain't Tzarich Lachzor, you don't need to go back. So that's the Aruch HaShulchan. But then he said, and he explains why, based on the Beis Yosef, this should be the halacha. He says that he thinks it's a svara. Well, what's the svara here? Yes, because just like in the summer, if you said the you said you asked for rain in the summer, you don't need to go back and do it because you never know, they could use rain also. He says that I don't know if actually that's how we decide halacha, but that's the basis. So he says it's the same thing. And then he says, lower isi lacha kain. He says, nevertheless, although this should be the halacha, that if you forget the same talamatar, because we don't really need rain in Russia. So at the end of the day, if you don't say it, what's the big deal? He says, nevertheless, all the Makatzrei Hadinim, that is these little books that tell you what the law is, they all said that you need to repeat it. And he doesn't think so. And then he says, I never have ruled this way that you have to repeat it. And he says that in my youth, I also heard that there was one of the other, one of the Gedolei Hador also did not want to rule like this, and that you don't have to repeat it. So it could be he's speaking about Rav Molavar. So let me tell you what Rav Molavar says. But even before getting to that, the Aruch HaShulchan concludes with something else, which, as far as I know, no one says to do. And it makes perfect sense. It's not in the Art Scroll laws. This is what he says. He says, regarding, he says, Vada, he says, and know this, that in all these places where you have to go repeat, right? You forget Mashiv HaRuach, all the times they tell you have to repeat, the Alaviyavo, whatever it is, he says, listen to this. If you can listen to the repetition of Shmoneh Esrei from the Shliach Tzibur, Mirosh Ad Sof, from beginning to end, Yatsa Bazeh, your Yotze. And then he tells us, these are, but you have to be careful to not make any hefsek. Don't talk, don't say Baruch HaRosh Shemo, because when someone's being motzi you, we don't say Baruch HaRosh Shemo. The Sfaradim, by the way, do say Baruch HaRosh Shemo, but we don't. When someone says HaMotzi, let's say, for you, or Kiddush for you, don't say Baruch HaRosh Shemo. Next Friday night, when someone's saying Kiddush, you don't say Baruch HaRosh Shemo. He says, just say Amen. And then he says, V'tzarech Iyun b'chol. So it requires investigation. But nevertheless, he says before that, he says, Im Yachol Yishmoa Yer Yotze. So has anyone ever heard this, that you don't need to repeat? That you can sit and listen carefully to the Shliach Tzibur, and that's enough. I've never heard anyone say this. I was never told this. And the Aruch HaShulchan says you are Yotze. And the fact that afterwards he says, I don't think that retracts what he says, that you're Yotze. I think he just means that this needs further investigation on this matter, because other people haven't accepted it. But he does issue, unless I'm misunderstanding this, and but I don't see. He says you don't say, and he says vidah, that any that which they say you need to repeat im yachol ishmo atfilu meshatz you don't say. And when he says v'sarachli b'chozeh, he might be referring to what he says in the entire paragraph at the beginning about the same talamatar, that you don't need to repeat it. Someone asked you if you forget. So what does Rav Molavar say? And this could be who he's referring to. Rav Molavar says, it appears to me that if you forgot to say the same talamatar in our country, when what is in the winter, what is rain in the winter in Russia? Eino ela siman klala b'chorif. It's a bad thing. Now, I don't know. I think years ago we would say that in America, if you get rain in the winter, it's bad. But now we know that they need it to fill the reservoir, all these things. So, but he's saying that ain't tzarech lachzor lispalel. And he says that the same. It's the same psak that the Ramos says, that if you asked for rain in the summer in a place where they need rain, you don't repeat it. This is what the Aruch HaShulchan was quoting. Like if you're in a place that needs rain in the summer, but we don't ask for rain, we say the same bracha, but you mistakenly ask for rain, you don't repeat it. So he says it's the same thing. If you don't ask for rain in a place that doesn't need it, you don't go back. And he says, especially, he says, if you say Vasain Talamata in a place where you don't, where you need rain, but you don't, you're not supposed to. It's not part of the davening. Nevertheless, we say it's fine. You change the matbeah of the bracha. Kal v'chomer of Oliver says shevel tase. If you didn't say Vasain Talamata, he says you don't have to go back and repeat it because we don't need it. He says this is what it appears to me, but he acknowledges this. He says Ela shalom nizkar b'shem posek, but he says no posek mentions this. So as far as I know, the standard halacha is that we are supposed to repeat it. Although this idea that you can listen to the chazan makes perfect sense. I don't know if that's been accepted. I see it's already 9:27, so I'll stop. So what we'll do next class is. Interesting halacha, some interesting halacha questions that Rav Molover asked, especially as they reflect the era he's in. So we'll do that, and a few other points of note, and then we'll bring it all to a close next class. Let me get to the questions here, the comments. Jacob says, for the few of us who grew up with Sephardic Hebrew, not filtered through the Israeli experience, modern Ivrit sounds somewhat foreign. Many of the letters are lost. Oh, okay, so that's what I was thinking of, the ayin. Chet, tet, kuf. Real Sephardim pronounce chet. We know they pronounce chet. They pronounce ayin. They pronounce kuf differently. And dagesh, not dagesh. And as you say, the stresses are one big mishmash. Duresh is European, not Semitic. That's correct. The Shvanach are different. So perfect, exactly what I wanted to say. You expressed it so beautifully, Jacob. Thank you. Thank you for that. Shvanah is basically not used at all in spoken Hebrew. It's used in Kriyas HaTorah, and it has to be used. But I mean, whenever you have hey and a word with a shva afterwards in spoken Hebrew, you would pronounce it. You'd say hasfaradim. You don't say hasifaradim. I mean, you would always you'd keep it as a shva nach. But in davening, it should be so. For example, you shouldn't say hamvorach. Baruch Hashem hamvorach. It should be hamevorach. But in spoken Hebrew, we don't really have the shvanah so much. And then you say Moshe Habertal's a theory of Maimonides' philosophy of Avelut, which explains why it's in Shoftim. Yes, that's a section of Moshe Habertal's book where he try. I found it the least interesting section, but it's quite significant. He's the first one I think to do that, but it doesn't make for exciting reading. But he tries to give explanations. They're really the best explanations I think that have been given. And there, Rabbi Kelman, thank you for the link to the talk on the Satmar Rebbe. Yes, Gershon, Rabbi Moshe Heyer, Marvin Heyer tells me nearly every Shabbos about the close, friendly relationship between Rav Aaron Cutler and the Rav. Rabbi Heyer loves them both, of course. Yes, they had obviously they disagreed on matters, but on a personal basis, they were in communication, and it's worth noting. Now, if I'm not mistaken, since you mentioned Rabbi Heyer, correct me if I'm wrong, didn't Rabbi Heyer give the inaugural benediction in 2016 at the Trump inauguration?
Yes, he did.
I'm thinking of that only because it was just announced today that Rabbi Ari Berman is going to give the inaugural benediction at the Trump inauguration next week, and I'm thinking that Heyer, Gershon, did Rabbi Heyer give the inauguration then?
He did.
He did. Okay, so my memory hasn't left me totally. So yes, and Rabbi Heyer, for those who don't know, has an autobiography, which I highly recommend. It is quite interesting, and I will end with this: the Ksas Shivcho, a little shevach to Rabbi Heyer. Maybe someone you could pass it on to him, Gershon. I've never had the honor, the pleasure of meeting Rabbi Heyer. Rabbi Heyer did something that it is amazing, unbelievable. In 1986, or 86, I think it was, a friend of mine, we flew to California. We saw all the sights. So for Shabbos, We wanted to be in Los Angeles near Yula, and someone said to call Rabbi Heyer. So we called Rabbi Heyer, and Rabbi Heyer did not know either of us from Adam. And he told us that he's going to be away. People told us to call him because they know he's a big, like Avraham Avinu, always having guests. So he wasn't going to be away. So you'd expect he's not going to be away. Say, okay, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be here. I'll get someone else. What he did was, we ate at the yeshiva, it wasn't a problem. He told us, now, mind you, he doesn't know me or my friend from Adam. We just spoke to him on the phone. He said, and this is before today, I have on my house, the combination lock that you use on Shabbos. You don't need to carry a key. I'd never seen anything like that then. This is a long time ago. He told us that he has a key on his door, like one of those door things. He said that we could stay in his house. And I'm like, no one else is going to be there. He says, no one's going to be there. And you'll stay there. So we stayed in Rabbi Heyer's house. I mean, who does this? That two people he didn't know. He let us stay in his house when he wasn't there. Forget worrying about stealing, breaking things. I mean, this is so you could pass that on, Nagershon. I never met Rabbi Heyer, and he probably doesn't remember this. But we stayed in his house, his big house, without him there. How he had the bitachon to let two strangers just stay in his house and just tell us the combination and in and out, come and go as you wish. That's something else. Let me tell you. And I don't think I would do that. So I have a lot of admiration. Okay, Rabbi
I
Kelman.
won't tell him that.
Okay, thank you, thank you. All right, next week we'll finish up as you just heard on this series. Thank you. Tomorrow, and then we'll start on the Langer case. Tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman will be continuous class on Yoshua. Wednesday, of course, I'm sure many of you know, Zev Elif will be beginning a new series, 10-part series on adventures in American history, all kinds of historical vignettes of American Jewish history. It's actually Dr. Mark who first introduced me to Zev Elif. I don't know, 10 years ago. Before he wasn't known at all back then, I don't think. But they said he's an up-and-coming star in and he's very good. He's very good. I'm sure those of you who have heard him know that. And then on Thursday, Shuli Mishkin will be beginning her series on reality, life in the time of the Talmud. And so those are the two new series beginning this week, and all the regular series. Rabbi Helfgott will consume Yeshayahu and the Parsha Shir and the Siddur Shir, etc., etc. Okay, as I tell, please invite a friend. I mean it. That's our best way of advertising our best. Them to try one of our classes. Want to wish everybody well. We should hear good news. And Dr. Shapiro raises, of course, that where I don't know if he's still here, but the balance between normalcy and in this situation going on. And Yago, I asked Gershon the other day, Yaakov, you're okay with the fires? And okay, I mean it's horrendous, but your area is okay in L.A.?
Yeah, Baruch Hashem, more in the flatlands, so it's
great danger now.
Now I hear the winds are picking up again. Is that what they say? I don't know. What
Exactly. Exactly.
I'm sorry. All
There's a
right,
danger.
what can I do? I just saw today in the news, if anybody saw, Israel apparently is developing their thing and they're going to start testing it next year, how to prevent wildfires from
Fire
spreading.
dome.
Right,
They're
they
going to
said
call it
some
the perfect.
iron dome against fire. Yeah, that was in today's paper I saw. So
She
hopefully,
was, yeah.
listen, it's we had when the city of Jasper, I mean, it's much smaller than L.A., but it's a big tourist place here. The city of Jasper basically burnt down this summer with the wildfires. And really, let's hope and pray they get it under control. We should hear good news. And okay, everybody, we'll look forward to learning with you soon. Laila Tov, be well, everybody. Thank you.